Good morning. It's good to see everybody out this morning. I say often that these colors run fast and hard, and that's really true. And yesterday, I mean, went to the Once Upon a Time books there in Tawnytown, and there's a lady running the register, and it was like maybe the first time she's ever seen a cash register before. And the line was getting longer and longer, and people were doing the shift. You know, everybody's changing their weight. And she's seeing this, and like you can see sweat start just coming down her face. We finally get up there and get checked out. And she said, "You don't want a receipt, do you?" And just as I was getting ready to say no, Missy said, "Yeah." Man, me and that lady both wanted to melt. So got the receipt, got off, went to another place and didn't have a price for a book. Do you want us to call and get a price? Yes, go ahead and call. And got a pretty good deal. So I'm glad that there are people that will stand their ground. Well, how many of you all would consider yourself a patient person? The kind of person, you know, that when somebody's supposed to do something and they don't do it immediately, that doesn't bother you. Maybe, like, though, we should probably ask our friends and our family, are you a patient person? Do they see that? Now, I consider myself normally a pretty fairly patient person. Some of you people may disagree, and you can be wrong. That's okay, right? Everybody's welcome here this morning. But in most things, I think that I'm pretty patient. A lot of things that get people worked up don't necessarily get me worked up, but a lot of things that do get me worked up don't get anybody else worked up. But I found a quiz on the very accurate website BuzzFeed, and there was a quiz there on how patient of a person are you. And as I'm going through that, I think I'm doing pretty good, but I'm also getting kind of bored, and I want to see like what the point of this survey is or this quiz is. So I go all the way to the bottom, and at the bottom it has this thing that says if you skipped all the way to the bottom, you're probably not a very patient person. Well, all right, whatever, right? That doesn't really annoy me. Like, people like me are behind those types of things, right? That's just one of those things. So it does sort of, I've seen a question, though, that says, does it annoy you when people are walking slowly in front of you? And that is sort of like the hard break right there, because, yeah, it really does. All of those feelings just kind of boil up when I want to get somewhere and somebody else doesn't. Like they're just taking their time. It just really, that's what grinds my gears, right? So there are things that annoy us, the things that we lose our patience with, and it may be something simple like that, or it may be something more significant. Now, way back in 2006, if you can remember all the way back then, the Associated Press did a survey about the impatience of citizens of the United States of America. It's pretty fascinated by the results. And keep in mind, 2006, right? It says while waiting in line or at an office or a store, it takes an average of 17 minutes for most people to lose their patience. On the phone, it's about 9 minutes. For women, it's about 18 minutes, and men, it's for 15 minutes. So we're a little bit more impatient. But here's what I kind of took from that survey. It's pretty generous in its evaluation of people, right? I don't think it takes anywhere near that long. I say 30 seconds to a minute is about how long it takes people to get impatient. And if you don't believe me, go to Walmart and watch somebody try to check out at the self-checkout with their bananas. Those people will lose their mind. Or like when we finish up here, well, let's all of us go to Brahms and get in line for ice cream. Like, see how patient we are then. Those workers, you know, they're working as hard as they can, but there's not enough of them for that big of a crowd to show up. And you see that line build, and you would see the frustration start to build, as well as when the food isn't coming out fast enough. We're just really an impatient culture. And really, we deal with it so often, I think because we are an impatient culture, we're kind of a self-centered culture. Every one of us sort of has a plan that we think this is the way things should go. But when the plan doesn't go according to my plan, we get frustrated, right? We think this should work out the way that I wanted it to. And that would be okay, right? If I were the only person living today, that would be okay. But I'm not the only person alive. And we all have our own wills. And sometimes we have a will that's really outside of our own will, that's pushing and dictating and narrating some of our life to us. We are accustomed to all the conveniences of our culture that we get upset when we are simply inconvenienced. So let's talk a little bit about that this morning. We've been looking at people that meet Jesus as he's going to the cross. As Jesus is losing his life, these people are sort of gaining their lives, so to speak. And so we're looking at those people, and today we're going to look at a guy who was severely inconvenienced. And I gave Bob the wrong scripture to read. We should have read something out of Luke 24 about Simon. So to kind of set the stage for that, we'll back that up. Last week, we had Jesus before Pilate. He's on trial for crimes he did not commit and still is sentenced to death. Jesus takes Barabbas' place, Barabbas' cross, and he's to be crucified on it. And it's Pilate, the Roman governor, that sends Jesus on that journey. And so we'll read what Bob read there in Matthew 27, where it says that then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and they put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. A lot of scholars and historians believe that this was an unusually severe beating here. Partly how the story goes, but also how it's described. Crucifixions, we all know, are a gory business. And I know if we could speak to the dead, and I'm sure none of them would agree that their crucifixion was less than, right? They would all say it's a pretty horrible way to die. There's no way around that. And if all they did was hang a person up on the cross to slowly die from that means, sort of from the elements, it could take weeks for someone to die. They would have to die of, again, elements or starvation and weakness rather than anything else. And that really isn't Rome's style because Rome was really into efficiency. Now, they weren't above, you know, bringing pain and agony to someone, but they wanted to do it efficient. And just leaving a person to hang for a while, that's not very efficient. So beforehand, a lot of times, they would rough somebody up. They would get them into a weakened state to put them on the cross so they would only last for days instead of weeks. And so we know, as the story goes, Jesus doesn't even last one day. And so a lot of scholars back up and say that it's quite possibly that his physical body, Now, obviously, Jesus willed it, right? This was all part of God's plan, but the physical body of him from this beating is severely beaten here. We also have the crown of thorns, and that's a new one, right? They did that in that moment. They did that particularly for Jesus, and we don't know really why they beat him more severely. It could have been because of that title that they were throwing around mockingly, right? Hail the King of the Jews. And there's a special place in the Romans' heart for their authority that they like to follow. And no one messes with the bosses of Rome, right? Nobody messes with the authority. In fact, they went to war with people who might challenge the authority of Caesar. Anyone who might say that they are a king, So that may be the case here, right? That they are punishing him more severely for that title. It may be that the Sanhedrin and the Jews that are surrounding this and are calling for his crucifixion are egging these soldiers on. And that's probably not a very normal occurrence for these Roman soldiers to have the Jewish people egging them on. And so maybe they're just getting a little bit more into this than usual. Well, we don't really know what all is going on here, but what we do know is that this beating was severe. And they leave Jesus after this beating, bloody and weak. So much so that John records in John 19:16 that finally Pilate delivered Jesus over to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the Place of the Skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. Now, there's kind of a detail in there that we might overlook sometimes. And a lot of those pictures we see of Jesus and there's somebody carrying the cross, and we can use that sometimes as backgrounds for different things, and they can help illustrate a point from time to time. But really, something quite different was going on. Most of the time, the prisoners had to bear the cross themselves. Sometimes they would already be tied to the cross beams as they're traveling through the city. Then again, not a modern-day city. Not even the side streets here in Concord would be much larger than the streets of Jerusalem of that day. The sort of those one-way streets where only one car can fit through them. Think of that and maybe minus it just a little bit. We might consider, again, the small streets of first century Jerusalem would have been very small streets. And it's very crowded, right, at this time of year. This is the time of the Passover. So everybody is in town, and they're starting there at really the kind of city center is where they're at, and they're going to travel outside of the city with the condemned as they're carrying their crossbeams. And if they're already tied to it, as some of the cases are, and it may have not been so much with Jesus, we don't really know those details, but they're trying here to navigate their way through a crowded city, carrying this large crossbeam, and that's got to be difficult. But again, we're talking about large crowds pushing in, no doubt mocking and jeering all the way. And these are the days before television and Netflix. I know that there were days before that, so I don't know if you all know that or not, but this was the days before that. But this was their form of entertainment. Social scientists today have a name for it. They call it painfortainment. And in the ancient world, people loved it when somebody would get condemned. They would make picnic baskets. The whole day would be planned around a crucifixion. And really, if we're not careful today, we still kind of love it. I mean, the Roman Colosseum was built basically for entertainment. It's that same kind of idea. Men are going to their death through the streets. You don't see that every day. So sure, everybody comes out to watch. The streets are crowded. The Roman soldiers are trying to kind of have to pave their way for the condemned to make it through the streets. All the while, these crowds are mocking and jeering and spitting upon the condemned. So we have Jesus carrying his cross through the streets, and the inevitable happens, right? He falls. And I don't know if it was a stumble. I don't know if it was intentional because he's God, right? He knows what the plan is, but he can't get up. Someone needs to help him. But just think about that scene. He's surrounded by hundreds, maybe thousands of people, and nobody offers to help. Now, like when I read the Bible, I like to imagine myself in certain scenarios throughout Scripture, not this one. I'm pretty sure that I would be part of that crowd. Now, I'd like to think higher of myself, but I'm pretty sure that I would fall into that crowd and be like, somebody ought to go help that guy. Not me. It's sort of like that old poem goes that says something like, everybody said that anybody could do all the good things somebody should do, but when everybody says anybody could do it, nobody did. I don't know that I got that right, but the whole point is whenever we think somebody should do it, most of the times we don't consider ourselves that somebody. I mean, where are the disciples? Surely the disciples would have been there, but we know they're not, right? They've already taken off and fled. Is there anyone? Soldiers aren't going to lift their finger to help. That's certainly not their job, and none of the crowd is. And apparently, so what happens is we're introduced to a guy named Simon. And in Mark 15:21, it says that they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell us this event. They tell us that there was a man from Cyrene named Simon who carried the cross of Jesus, and that's about all they say, right? But we can draw a few conclusions from the things that we have in this short little meeting from this man named Simon that he had with Jesus. First of all, this is Cyrene, if you can see that. Cyrene is a pretty large city in what is now modern-day Libya. And Libya is, of course, northern Africa there on the Mediterranean coast. And it was a large city. But it's also a city that has a pretty large Jewish population, so it wasn't a surprise that a guy from Cyrene shows up here in Jerusalem at Passover. Most Jews, considered that they wanted to make at least one pilgrimage for Passover, especially to Jerusalem in their lifetime. If they were far away, that was their hope, that their goal would be to someday make it to worship in that holy city, to make it to the temple and to worship there at one of these great Jewish festivals that they had in their lifetime. Well, again, Cyrene is about 800 miles from Jerusalem by land. And traveling in that day, of course, you didn't have a car to hop in or a plane to jump in. And so you either had to travel by foot or by animal, by land, or you could travel by sea. But if you're traveling by foot to go approximately 800 miles, it's about 57 days. Maybe you were lucky enough to have a camel or a horse or something, and you could cut it to 35 days. Now, if you were rich and had money to sail, you could do that in about 6 days, but you'd still have to do about 2 days' worth of traveling by land. We don't know how long it took Simon. We don't know his mode of travel. We just know where he was from, the Cyrene, and he was now in Jerusalem. Coming from that country that day, maybe he was late, right? Where a lot of pilgrims show up early, maybe something had happened and Simon was running behind. Maybe those two kids were asking the whole way, are we there yet? And he was just like, nope, only 33 more days to go. Can you just think about that? Imagine the traveling that. It may have been a once-in-a-lifetime journey for him. The fulfillment of a dream of significant spiritual impact. You can imagine worshiping your whole life, and you've participated in the Passover year after year, but this year you're going to get to do it in Jerusalem, in the holy city with all of the other pilgrims that are coming. This would be a special year. And we know as he's coming into the country, Jesus is heading out to the country. They're obviously going in opposite directions. And I don't know if Simon had ever heard of Jesus before. Cyrene's a long ways away. But even if he had, he wouldn't have recognized him because this guy, he's beat to a pulp, right? There's a good chance Simon didn't even know what was going on, but he sees this man falling under the cross, now a Roman soldier, and we know in this time that the Roman soldiers could conscript anyone, really the citizens of a country, to carry their load for up to a mile. This was actually part of the deal, that they could force somebody to carry their load that was under their care for up to a mile. We don't know why they picked Simon. Maybe he was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. Maybe he was a big guy, and they thought, well, this guy can carry a cross for sure. Maybe there was something about his appearance to the Romans that they didn't like. I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, we do know that these soldiers made a convenient choice and just pointed at Simon and said, you pick up the cross and carry it. And there's no getting out of that. There's no doctor's note that says, I've got a bad back. I can't carry the cross. This is the penalty of death now hangs over Simon's head. Go pick up the cross. But see, what was convenient for the soldiers was extremely inconvenient for Simon. I mean, this is sort of an obvious point, right? But this was not part of Simon's plan. Like whenever he's planning the itinerary with the kids, I know he did not come to a point where he says, okay, here's where we enter Jerusalem, and Daddy's going to take a little bit of a moment here where he needs to go help a guy to his crucifixion. I don't think that ever happened. That was not part of the plan. And when things don't go according to plan, it's extremely inconvenient. Simon had probably spent maybe 1 to 2 months making his way to Jerusalem as he enters the holy city. I mean, this is a pilgrimage. He's singing maybe the Psalms of Ascent as he enters the city. He's praising God as he comes. He's ready for this wonderful worship experience, and he's met with really a parade of death. Not only that, he gets conscripted to now be a part of this parade. He's forced to carry the cross through the streets and outside of the city gate, all of this time helping this disgusting and bloody man who's been beaten so severely. He may not even be recognizable, but not only is not his part, his plan, man, this has got to be an emotionally draining task. You think about that. Simon is following Jesus. He's got a front row seat to all the mocking, to everyone spitting on this man, all of the scorn, all of the hatred. He couldn't help but feel the mood of this crowd firsthand, and he's watching Jesus handle it, but no doubt, because crowds don't always separate certain things, right? He probably was at the receiving end of a lot of mocking as well. And now Simon himself has become part of this spectacle. And you know, like people down the block, they probably didn't know what people down the road had already said or done. And so they continue the same mocking and jeering. And Simon, who was just an innocent bystander, is now part of this spectacle, but probably the most inconvenient thing that we probably don't think of, but from Simon's perspective, is now Simon is unclean. And for us, that seems like small potatoes. If you're unclean, just go wash your hands, right? It's okay. You'll be fine. After you've done carrying the cross, you know, maybe just go to one of those baptismal pools that are stationed around Jerusalem and wash there. And then you'd be okay. But according to Jewish law, if you were unclean, you were unclean no matter what you did until the evening. And so here's the deal. We know that this is happening on the day of preparation for Passover. So Simon is here at the day of preparation. He's going to be unclean for Passover until the end of the day. In other words, Simon will not be able to participate in the Passover feast. The very second that he touches Jesus' cross, he realizes that his journey to come and celebrate Passover is taken away because he's unclean. And he won't be able to go and worship as he planned because he touched the blood of another person. Again, the very purpose for which Simon came to Jerusalem has been stripped away from him. And you think about that. All of the things that I get impatient for kind of seem pretty piddly when compared to that. A lot of the things that I get impatient for is just because maybe I don't want to be late, or not even that sometimes, right? I just want to be in a hurry. I want to get through something as fast as I can to get to the next thing. Very, very few times have the plans that I've worked on maybe for years, maybe your whole life, that has taken me 2 months on a journey to get to this point, and then for it all to just go away. That's more than an inconvenience. But here's Simon. Now, all of his plans have seemingly came to nothing, but God had different plans for Simon. This isn't necessarily the end of the story, or at least it isn't the whole story. We know, I mean, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all mention Simon, and I wish that there was a lot more to the story. But the thing is, we actually might consider back to what Mark has to say. There's a detail there. Mark says they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Now, why would Mark decide to tell us who his kids are? What would be the point, unless the readers, of course, knew who Alexander and Rufus were? Now, I think there's some merit to that, because if we fast forward to Romans, in the book of Romans, whenever Paul is sort of finishing up his introduction to the Roman church, he's sort of coming through there, and in chapter 16, he spends that whole chapter saying how great this person is and how great this person is. And really, Paul is sort of name-dropping, maybe to show this Roman church that he knows other people within the church. I don't know if Paul was insecure or what really all the point is of saying that I know all of these great people. But if you look at Romans 16:13, he says, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, also his mother, who has been a mother to me as well." And we know, right, that people can have the same name. We've got a couple of Bobs in the room right now. And we all know that Rufus, I don't know, I've known one Rufus in my entire life. It's not really a popular name, but maybe it was back then. But how this is written, most scholars believe that this is the same Rufus. This is Simon's son some 25 years later. Whenever Paul was writing to Romans, the same guy, I don't know if that's absolutely true, but I'm going to take some faith and believe that is true. It's a powerful story to see on this journey. If that is true, the journey which started for Simon sort of as a, not sort of, truly as a massive inconvenience and maybe even an embarrassment of plans not working out, I mean, really, you think about having to go back to his family. How was the festival, Simon? How was Passover there in Jerusalem? And he has to say, "I didn't make it." That's an embarrassment, right? That moment, though, becomes a journey of grace and transformation. So picture again Simon being forced to carry Jesus' cross, but instead of being part of the crowd and not even being Simon, picture yourself as Alexander or Rufus. You watch your dad pick up some other guy's cross who's following this guy to his death. We don't know how old they are, but you know that they are taking all of this in. They're watching, and they're listening to what the crowd says. They're hearing the charges about this man, and then at the cross, they're hearing the things that this man says. Things like, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," and other things that Jesus says. And at some point along their journey, whether it's that day or sometime later, they're going to hear that this man died in their place. That the cross should have been theirs because they had sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And so in that moment, whatever, whenever that moment comes, they realize and they become followers of Jesus, so much so that Rufus's mother adopts Paul, a missionary who in his own right bore the cross of Jesus in many ways. What started out as an inconvenient intrusion in their lives has now become a defining moment for their entire lives. This was clearly part of God's plan, something that Jesus would even foreshadow that maybe a lot of people don't realize. In Matthew 16:24, Jesus tells the disciples that if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And we often talk about that as the path of discipleship, that a disciple should take up the cross and follow Jesus. Simon is literally the first person to pick up a cross and follow Jesus. And he shows us how it's done. He teaches the next generation how to do it as well. And I'm sure that Rufus and Alexander teach the next generation to do it. And the thing is taking up the cross of Christ is never convenient. And I wish it was something that we could sort of schedule. I like plans. I like certain things to be done on certain days, and it sort of gives me within that structure a little bit more flexibility in doing things. And so I like to be able to say, okay, I know I'm doing this at this time. I would love to be able to say, all right, Jesus, we can plan whatever you want to pick up your cross. Let's do it Wednesday at 2, right? That's pretty silly. One time I did a funeral with a guy, and the family we were meeting with told him, I'd like you to do my funeral. And he gave the best answer ever. He said, I'm free next Tuesday. It was not the answer maybe that they wanted to get. Don't take any offense to that. But the thing is it's never convenient to pick up the cross of Christ. It never fits in within your plans that you have for that day. It can be emotionally draining. You can have, as the kids say, you can have emotional damage from that, and it can mess up your entire plans for the rest of your future. But when you take up the cross of Christ, it messes up your plans for the better. It may not be convenient, but it's always convicting. When you pick up your cross and you follow Jesus, that beaten and slaughtered lamb, that revelation will point to. Jesus is ready for you to do that you realize that victory is already won. And it may be an unpleasant sight in the moment, but on the other side is glory. And it is amazing, and it's something that none of us would ever want to miss. And you wouldn't want all of those little inconveniences to slip away if it meant you would miss that day. So we should be a people that has maybe a little bit more patience. Maybe be a people that has a little bit more grace. But may we also be a people, especially whenever asked, when Jesus says, will you take up this cross, my cross, upon you, that we don't look at him and say, can I do that later? Can I schedule that when it's a little bit more convenient? Let's not ever let those words or thoughts creep into our heads or come out of our mouths. May we simply say, yes, Lord. How far are we going and follow the whole way? Let's hope that can define us now and every day of our lives as we look forward. And so this morning, if you need to take up the cross of Christ, I won't lie, it's a burden, right? Sometimes it is inconvenient, but it's a blessed inconvenience. And it's an inconvenience that can change your life. And so this morning, if you need to take up the cross this morning, we welcome you. We welcome you on that journey of following Jesus every day of your life. The baptismal waters are ready for you. If you have any need or you need prayers or some understanding of some sort that the congregation needs to be aware of and you'd like to make that known, please come as together we stand and we sing.